Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. And won't it be fun to talk about people like, actually, chapters 2 through 10 of the book feature 9 men whose candidacies have had the greatest impact on our political system and where that impact can be felt today. People like Henry Clay, Stephen Douglas, William Jennings Bryan, Al Smith, Adlai Stevenson, Barry Goldwater, George McGovern, and also a special chapter on 3 recent also-rans, Al Gore, John Kerry, and John McCain. Our guest has run for office as well. Scott Ferris is a former bureau chief for the United Press International and a political columnist who's interviewed many of the men and women who have sought the presidency over the past 30 years. He's managed several political campaigns, and he was a 1998 congressional nominee for Wyoming's at-large district, the seat once held by former Vice President Dick Cheney. He lost that race, but if he had won, maybe we wouldn't have the book. His loss led to his ruminations on the role that losers play in a democracy. And why losers now, some of the book looks at this, tend to fade from sight, whereas losers in earlier times intended to be the titular head of the party that they were representing. So it should be a really fun hour. Our number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. You can leave messages on our Facebook page. Oh, all these avenues are available to you, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We would love to hear your comments. Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a great privilege to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And so we wouldn't have the book if you had won that race, do you think?
You know, I don't think we would have.
I'm kind of glad I lost. So you feel better about it already.
I do. It's making lemonade out of lemons.
Exactly. I was interested in the early part of the book when you talked about losing candidates maintaining the role of titular head of their party's leading spokesperson for a long time. Why did that change, and how important did they used to be?
Well, they used to be quite important, and you still, I think Adlai Stevenson was the last losing candidate who was still the acknowledged titular head of his party, of the Democratic Party. And I think a lot of it has been two things. One, I think we can increasingly see failure, defeat, as a character defect, as opposed to just something that happened that was out of your control. I think that has continued to gain momentum since the industrial age. And then the other one, obviously, is television. Television provides images of losing that kind of get indelibly inscribed in our collective memory. You think about poor Mike Dukakis in the tank, or John Kerry saying he voted for it before he voted against it. Those kind of things remind people of why they lost, and so they're not considered quite as credible spokespersons as those who had the luxury of being losing candidates before the age of television. So I note in the book that John McCain, I think, has tried to resurrect the idea of being the titular head of the Republican Party. He's been one of the strongest, most vocal critics of President Obama over the last couple of years, but it just doesn't seem to have taken hold the way it would have done in the 19th century.
You talk about if they are allowed to speak at all, their parties may fear their very appearance on TV will attach the stench of past failure to the present campaign. Do you think that it would do that?
Well, I think the consultants think it would, and so they sort of try to organize the campaigns and the conventions around that. I remember, going back to Mike Dukakis, didn't see much of Mike Dukakis at the 1992 convention.
No.
Didn't see Bob Dole at the 2000 Republican convention. So I do think that there's sort of a sense that, look, we don't want to remind people of why we lost 4 years ago. We want them to look ahead. This is the brand new party. And in fact, that's one of the roles the loser plays, is that they give each political party kind of a chance to sort of redefine themselves, refine their message, and move forward. As opposed to if you've won, you feel like, well, we had a pretty good message. Everything's going pretty well. We can keep doing what we did before. And so it's the losing campaigns that provide the dynamism for changing the political dialogue.
Well, let's give Henry Clay his due. This guy ran for president, you reminded me, 3 times, for heaven's sake. And you talk about him being considered the greatest legislator in American history, and yet who pays very much attention to him? Not many.
You know, I was particularly glad to bring more attention to Henry Clay. He's also been the subject of a couple of recent biographies, which has been nice as well, because he really was one of the giants of American history. Most people, if they know him, have heard of him being part of the great Senate triumvirate of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun. But he did a couple of things legislatively. The reason I say that he's probably the greatest legislator is the Speaker of the House position, which we now sort of consider the second most powerful political position in the American government. When the Republic started out, it was a very minor, mostly ceremonial post. And it was Clay who had the idea, well, no, the Speaker should be the guy who decides what committees each congressman gets to sit on and which where the bills go to each committee, and really running the House. And he was the first one to do that. And it was interesting. He was elected the Speaker of the House as a freshman congressman even before they actually convened. That's how obvious his leadership skills were to his colleagues. And so he transformed the speakership, and then he went into the U.S. Senate, where he became a very powerful voice for very close to 30, 40 years, and, of course, engineered three very important compromises that helped to at least avert civil war for a while. So just a tremendously interesting man. Great skills, great vision, and so he's one of those people. Sometimes ask me, who do you think should have won? He's one of those people where America probably missed a good bet on who could have been a great or near great president.
What, why did he lose three times?
Well, first time was bad luck. In 1824, there were four very credible candidates running: Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams. People mostly heard of those two, and a guy from Georgia named William Crawford, who was a very prominent senator, and then Clay. But Clay made a couple of mistakes, and then he had some bad luck. He had some electors in Louisiana, for example, who were ready to go to the polls, and they had a carriage accident.
Oh.
And so they weren't able to vote. And so he missed out on being winning the top three by one vote. And the top three finishers in that election then, you know, went to the House of Representatives because nobody had a clear majority. Clay was Speaker of the House, and everybody had assumed if he had gotten that one extra vote,
oh,
he would have been
gosh.
President.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was just bad luck. Eventually, Clay decided to support Adams because he just hated Andrew Jackson, and then that caused one of the great political feuds in American history between Jackson and Clay. But then he lost in 1832 because Jackson was very popular, and then he lost in 1844 because he had the wrong position on annexation of Texas, of all things. And he kept running. Actually, that was three times he was nominated, had a major party support to be a candidate. He also, ran two or three other, wanted to be president two or three other times. And even up until his dying day, the last year he died in 1852, he was still hoping they might nominate him one more time.
I'm always interested in these early presidents or would-be presidents' position on slavery. You write about this, that he talked about slavery being a great evil, but how do we reconcile that with owning slaves? Was that a big issue in his candidacies?
It absolutely was. In fact, that was also in 1832, I mentioned, when he lost to Jackson. That was one of the things that, in 1844, that cost him the presidency, was he had made the abolitionists very upset. The abolitionists were still a pretty small number there, but there were some significant numbers, kind of like Ralph Nader in Florida in 2000. The abolitionist party, the Liberty Party in New York, had just enough votes they swung the state to Polk instead of Clay, and again, that would have also helped him. He would have won the election if he'd carried New York. But the abolitionists thought Clay was the worst sort of hypocrite. I mean, Polk was an unapologetic slave owner. Clay owned slaves but felt guilty about it. And talked about, as you said, how evil slavery was, how he wishes he could figure out a solution to ending slavery, but it was blessed by the Constitution, so how do you do that? And so Clay was one of the people who helped form the society to colonize, the African Colonization Society. The idea was that you, as African Americans became free, you would then pay their way to go back to Africa. And, of course, this wasn't a viable plan at all, of course, but it was one Abraham Lincoln adopted. Abraham Lincoln was a great disciple of Henry Clay's. In fact, the Lincoln presidency was probably a lot in terms of policy, what a Clay presidency would have looked like. So he did have very ambivalent feelings. He knew it was wrong. He freed all of his slaves upon his death, freed some of them during his lifetime. But his probably great tragedy was he was such a great legislator, but he couldn't figure out the right legislative compromise to end slavery.
Yeah. It's too bad somebody couldn't have, so we didn't have to go through all we subsequently went through, right? And some would say are still going through.
I think so.
You mentioned, and he has a special place in my heart because my grandmother, God bless her, was very political and was a campaign organizer for Edley Stevenson in Northern Illinois. I've subsequently grown to be fond of Dwight Eisenhower, but Stevenson you include, and I think this is interesting because he begs the question, could we have had an egghead as president?
You know, it's funny. We go through this debate now every 4 years about which party is the party of intellectual elites and which is the party of flyover country and the average American. And oddly enough, that started in 1952 with the Stevenson campaign. And Stevenson has become the model, even before Jack Kennedy, Adlai Stevenson has become sort of the model of the liberal ideal of a candidate. He was very urbane, very witty, very articulate, very eloquent. And there was a lot of talk about, does he talk over the heads of the American people? And Stevenson said, well, I did once when I was speaking from a bridge and the people were down below. But he said, other than that, I didn't think I was talking over the heads of the people. But he really inspired an awful lot of people, especially after World War II. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people looking for, like, what was this all about? Are we going to have a brave new world that really stands for something new and different? Are we going to slide back into the horrors of the 1930s and 40s? So he did inspire an awful lot of people, and I argue that he paved the way for Kennedy and how almost all subsequent liberal candidates for president talk. And then this whole debate about, was he too smart to be president? Was he too intellectual? And that, interesting, I think the Republicans thought that was a winning issue because Eisenhower and his running mate Richard Nixon would go way out of their way to talk about how they were just plain folks. If Eisenhower would use a phrase like status quo, he would actually apologize and say, well, excuse me, I'm not supposed to be the educated candidate, which is ridiculous because he was the president of Columbia University. You know, so Eisenhower was hardly a plain, ordinary guy. But that all started that, and it's interesting. We see it today, you know, with Obama. You know, was he just, he's a professor. He's a constitutional law professor who has these wonderful, fancy-sounding phrases, but can he connect with the average person? So obviously that's been an enduring legacy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because I find that fascinating, whether or not we want our presidents to have pretty high IQs and to be extremely smart. Do we want that? Do we struggle with that? Do we sort of want that, but we also want the person we have a cup of coffee with and can talk about our families? What do we want, and what have we wanted historically?
I think we wanted it all. I think that's been one of the problems. I think we want both things, and it depends on the tenor of the times. I think people do want a president who's obviously intelligent. I mean, I think nobody wants to have the leader of our country be somebody who's a below-average intelligence. I think we know what a complicated job it is, and it requires great skills, intellectual as well as political. On the other hand, we also want somebody we think can relate to our problems, who understands what we're going through and what we can do. So we kind of bounce back and forth. Remember, again, back to 2000, one of the things that Bush partisans often asked, well, who would you rather have a beer with, Al Gore or George W. Bush? And George W. Bush seemed more affable, more likable to some people. And, of course, he actually didn't win the popular vote, so you could say, well, maybe more people thought about Al Gore. But there was that debate about who understands you, who's more like me, who can relate to me. But obviously Americans have repeatedly elected men who have great intellectual qualification. We talk about Stevenson. Well, Kennedy had won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Profiles in Courage. Jimmy Carter was a nuclear engineer. Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar. Obama was an accomplished author. So obviously there have been times when Americans have no trouble electing somebody with great intellectual capabilities, but other times, sometimes they may feel, I just want somebody who can more relate to my daily struggles.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at this issue of losing and how important it has been. And you compare this, which I hadn't really thought about before, to how losing parties or losing individuals in other countries can really create huge problems in a country that can lead to riots if they don't concede graciously. That has been extremely important in the transition of power in America. Was there ever a time when the loser did not concede graciously and problems ensued?
Well, not in American history, really. Oddly enough, it's been, I mean, there have been a few people who have been a little peckish about it. I mentioned that, you know, Goldwater was not, and McGovern, neither one of them were too gracious in their concession speeches. Tom Dewey, I think, and Charles Evans Hughes are two other folks who sort of delayed a while making their concession because they were surprised that they had lost. But generally, you've always had the losing candidates in American political history, presidential political history, sort of grudgingly move on, wish their the man who defeated them well, promising to help unite the country, usually reserving a little bit of wiggle room there to pursue policies that they care about. But we've been very fortunate. And even in the Civil War, which you would say, well, what about 1860, that wasn't really precipitated by the behavior of losing presidential candidates. In fact, I devote a chapter, as you mentioned, to Stephen Douglas, who I think behaved heroically in that campaign, even if, you know, though Douglas wasn't nearly as enlightened as Lincoln on the issue of slavery. But Douglas was very strong in support of the Union. And so when he became clear in the fall of 1860 he was going to lose to Lincoln, he devoted the rest of his campaign trying to convince the South. He traveled right through the heart of the South and was pelted with rocks and rotten fruit and threatened with hanging. And to convince the South that they shouldn't secede, that they had no right to secede, and that Lincoln would be a fine president and they could work with him. And he continued to do that after Lincoln's election and really worked himself basically to death. He died in June after the election. And so even his behavior was exemplary. So, but you said in other countries, a lot of times the losing candidate will just say, well, I didn't lose, or I'm not leaving office. They'll encourage their partisans to go into the streets to riot. In 2008, when Obama beat McCain in a very heated election, there were 1,500 people killed in Kenya around election year riots.
My.
When Sarkozy won in 2007, that inspired riots that injured hundreds. So we're very fortunate in this country that the losing candidates have decided to be very gracious
mm-hmm.
And for the good of the country, rally the nation.
We also, though, remember people like Richard Nixon, who seemed to be a fairly sore loser when he was talking about... Well, it wasn't in the Checkers speech where he was being accused of illicit money in his campaign fund, but he seemed to have that air about him of being a sore loser.
Well, actually, I take issue with that. He was in 1962 when he lost the governorship of California. He gave his famous press conference where he said, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Right.
But in 1960, when there was very strong evidence, as Robert Caro's new book on Johnson sort of reminds us once again, when there was very strong evidence that the election had been stolen, Nixon was actually quite gracious to Kennedy. A lot of people were encouraging him to challenge the results in Texas and Illinois, and he said no. He said, I don't want to be known as a sore loser. We're in the middle of the Cold War. I don't want to put the country at risk. I'm still a young man. I'll get my chance later on. So he very graciously conceded to Kennedy with some very generous words. So even Nixon, I think, despite his other thing, the most peckish concession was from Davy Crockett. I put that in the book. You know, Davy Crockett was a congressman and he lost, and he was so mad he told the voters in Tennessee, "You can all go to hell. I'm going to Texas."
And Nixon and Kennedy became fairly good friends, didn't they? I mean, not buddy buddies, but Kennedy solicited his advice, and they had some meetings.
They had, you know, they had been first congressmen and then senators together. Chris Matthews' first book goes into great detail about the Kennedy-Nixon friendship, and they had offices across the hall from each other, and there's some debate about just how close they were, but they were definitely on friendly terms and I think respected each other's intellect.
Why do we remember Barry Goldwater? Why is he in the book?
Barry Goldwater, interesting, and I hope we can talk about George McGovern too, but Barry Goldwater, of course, lost one of the most decisive elections in American history. He just was absolutely crushed in 1964, and everybody said, Barry Goldwater has discredited conservatism forever. If you look back at all the political pundits in the fall of 64, that's what they wrote. Well, of course, that's not what happened at all. The Goldwater campaign, in fact, represented the turning point in which the conservative wing of the Republican Party gained ascendancy and dominance over the party. And what I say in the book is the most important thing that Goldwater did is he began the process of converting the South from Democratic, solidly Democratic, for generations to being now the bedrock of Republican support. And he did that. Of course, race relations were the key issue in that part of the world in the 1960s. And what Goldwater had done was vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the few Republicans who did. And you think about if Nelson Rockefeller had been the nominee in 64, as many people had predicted. Rockefeller was very strong for civil rights. The South would have gone in a different direction. But because Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act, he actually converted the South from being kind of a populist Democratic region to being a conservative Republican region. And again, that is absolutely the source of Republican electoral strength today. And you trace all that back to Goldwater in 64. And of course, the conservative takeover of the Republican Party led to Reagan's presidency in 1980 and then the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994.
Why did he lose to Johnson by such huge numbers, Scott?
Well, I think two things. I think one, several reasons. First of all, of course, with Kennedy's assassination, the nation wanted to enshrine Kennedy's legacy. That's what Johnson promised to do. And I think even Goldwater said he knew he had no chance to beat Johnson in the wake of Kennedy's assassination. Goldwater had looked forward to running against Kennedy. They also were, like Nixon, he and Kennedy were actually fairly good friends and liked each other. Kennedy didn't think Goldwater was all that bright, to be very honest, but they were looking forward to debate each other, and he was looking at a very clear contrast in issues. But once Kennedy was shot, Goldwater said he knew he had no chance. So there was that part. But then, of course, Goldwater talked a very extreme rhetoric. He talked about lobbing a nuclear missile into the men's room of the Kremlin. He talked about privatizing Social Security. He talked about selling the Tennessee Valley Authority. And so he made people very nervous that he was too extreme. And, when he gave his convention speech in 1964, he gave that famous phrase that extremism is in the pursuit of liberty is no vice. Mm-hmm. This was at a time when extremism, in the wake of a presidential assassination, was absolutely not what you wanted to convey. Mm-hmm. So he was, but that was Barry Goldwater. He did what he wanted to do, and if he didn't like it, heck with you. And then finally, I do think the race thing played out. 1964 was also a turning point. We're talking about the war on women today. Up until 1964, Republicans tended to get the majority of the women's vote, and Goldwater, and as well as a large share of the African American vote. With Goldwater, African Americans completely desert the Republican Party, and women start to vote more often Democratic than Republican. And I think that's partly on the basis of the civil rights discussion. And so it was a very important campaign in American history, even though at the time it seemed absolutely disastrous.
Mm-hmm. George McGovern, before we go to phone calls, you write, which is interesting, liberal Democrats should view George McGovern's landslide loss to Richard Nixon in 72 as the precursor to the presidency of Barack Obama and, for that matter, the 2008 presidential candidacy of Hillary Clinton as well.
I do. Again, another race where the loser just lost in a landslide. And again, if the pundits just flipped it on their head in 1972. I said, in 64 they wrote that Goldwater discredited conservatism. In 72 they wrote that McGovern had discredited liberalism. What McGovern understood in 1972 was that the demographics had changed in the old New Deal coalition of the Democratic Party, which was organized labor and people of ethnic background living in big cities. They'd moved to the suburbs. They were dispersing. And if the Democratic Party wanted to maintain a majority, they needed to change. And so he wanted to reach out even more to minorities. He was the first presidential candidate to really reach out to Hispanic voters, which is now in a very important constituency of the Democratic Party. He courted women voters very aggressively. They had the first women's rights plank. It was in the Democratic platform in 1972. And Democrats have consistently done well with working women and single women since then. He was the first presidential candidate to have a gay rights platform. Think about all the debate this year on same-sex marriage. And he reached out, he really tried to inspire the young and to bring the young, and especially educated activists, environmental activists, people like that. And so he created a new coalition that in 1972 was pretty small. But that coalition has grown, and if you look at who elected Barack Obama in 2008 and who Barack Obama is trying to appeal to today, it is women, it is minorities, it's the young, it's activists who care about things like the environment. So even though McGovern looked like he had really pulled a boner in 1972, the fact is that he had laid the framework for what is now the Democratic majority.
Scott Ferris, our guest this hour, his book is Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. We've highlighted just a few of the chapters in the book and the people who lost who he feels have had lasting impact on democracy in this country. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This audience votes, I know, and some of you have voted for quite some time now. It would be interesting to hear you talk about somebody you voted for who lost, perhaps, and you would agree with Scott that that person has made a huge impact on American society. And what about the idea of the people who lose fading from view because the party doesn't want to be associated with a loser? Those people worked very hard. Sometimes they have terrific resumes. They care about the American people. Should they have some kind of position? U.S. Senator at large, as one of the losers recommended, we'll find out who in a moment, to utilize their talents, their skills. Or are they best just forgotten? 800-486-8655 is the number. Patrick in Minnesota is our first caller. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. My question was, why does the Democratic Party kind of forget their fallen leaders? I was just in Sioux Falls, and Senator McGovern is obviously still alive. His family had went through personal strife. There weren't many people there. But I remember as a young man growing up in 1972 watching that election. I must have been 8 years old, and I'm, with all transparency, I'm a conservative, but I thought he was a nice guy when I was a kid, and I was really disappointed that he didn't get elected, and just that history didn't really appreciate him. What are your comments on that?
Well, thank you, Patrick. I agree with you. First of all, I would agree with the point you made that the Democrats seem to be even do a worse job than Republicans in terms of remembering the losers. I think the Republicans do tend to do a better job of sort of patting the guys on the back and saying thank you for doing that, partly because I think maybe the Republicans are a little more hierarchical party. We always talk about how the Republicans always sort of nominate whoever it is their turn, somebody who sort of earned their way up the ladder. That Romney, because he'd done so well in 08, is going to be the nominee this year. McCain, because he'd run before in 08, et cetera. So I do think there's some of that, that the Democrats, because they're always sort of reforming and remaking themselves, are we liberals, are we new Democrats, are always ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and it's just a shame. But back to McGovern particularly, I agree. I think especially given the fact that I think on so many issues, we now look back and we see that McGovern was right. I think in 1972, he talked a lot about, obviously, the Vietnam War, how it was a mistake if the United States didn't have a policy to win. What were we doing over there? We should get the troops home right away. I think that now we look back, generally people see that our strategy in Vietnam was wrong, and he was probably right. He talked a lot about Nixon's character, about how Nixon, you know, just was too lustful for power. And, of course, we found out after Watergate he was right about that. So it's really odd, particularly with McGovern, that he was vindicated on so many different issues, that he is a little more revered. As I said in the book, you know, conservatives in the Republican Party now look at back in Goldwater. There's tons of books about Goldwater and how what that campaign meant to all these conservative activists and how important it was. Almost no memoirs about McGovern, and I think it's a real shame, especially when you think about how many people cut their teeth on the McGovern campaign. Gary Hart was his campaign manager. Bill and Hillary Clinton helped coordinate his campaign in Texas. So a lot of people, I wish McGovern had a much better legacy. Interesting, just real quick side story. You know, the C-SPAN did a little series on losing presidential candidates last fall called The Contenders, and I had the opportunity to go to Mitchell, South Dakota, where I was going to interview Senator McGovern as part of the show. And unfortunately, Senator McGovern tripped on the way over to the studio.
Oh, I remember that.
And hurt himself, and so we didn't get to have him on the show. And it was too bad because we talked in the afternoon. He was very excited because he doesn't get a lot of chances to talk about what he would have done and what his legacy of his campaign was. So he's a great man and a great gentleman, and I hope he's feeling much better now.
Well, part of the problem, don't you think, we've had him on many times because he has family connections in Milwaukee, and he's written a whole lot of books, too, very thoughtful books about hunger and peace and his involvement in World War II. He's a very, very thoughtful man and historian. It's striking to me that it's another case of the press perhaps ignoring people who have a whole lot to say. He's of the World War II generation. And have you seen him on television on any analysis shows? No, you just haven't. Here, why wouldn't we use somebody like that? You know, it's a great honor for us to be able to have him on the air, as it was Senator Dole has been on the air with us several times, too. Why not use that wisdom?
I agree. I think it's a terrible waste, and it's just foolhardy because, again, you know, as I put in the book, you know, it's every election's about a choice, and sometimes this is important to know why people didn't choose somebody is why they did choose somebody,
mm-hmm.
and I think we could learn a lot. And again, as you said, you go back and you say, okay, the last 4 years obviously didn't work out. Let's go back and look at the critique and the alternative way we could have gone. Would that have been better? We actually could sort of look at that, and if we took a little more thoughtful approach. You know, Alice, you were mentioning somebody who had recommended they become sort of honorary senators at large. That was Al Smith's idea.
Oh.
And he had been, you know, the losing candidate in 1928, the first Catholic nominated for president. And he also felt, he said, you know, I have all this experience. I've traveled the country. I've learned a lot. And now I have nowhere to put all this knowledge. It is a shame. It's a waste. And I wish we could figure out a way to tap this expertise.
And talk a little bit more about that election in 1928, Al Smith. We should do a show on that sometime. Was it indeed his Catholicism that kept him from being elected, or were other things equally at play?
Well, I think he would have had a tough time winning because during the 8 previous years of Republican administration, there had been prosperity, of course. This was the roaring 20s, and people didn't think that was going to end. They couldn't see that the Depression was just around the corner. But the margin of defeat was so large because he was a Catholic. I think that's pretty much irrefutable, and that made both Al Smith and many American Catholics quite bitter. Because there was just, I think a lot of people had thought, well, you know, anti-Catholicism was a relic of the 19th century. Catholics had proven their patriotism in World War One and elsewhere, and certainly we'd put that aside. But the 1920s was also the heyday of the renewal of the Ku Klux Klan. There was a lot of anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic sentiment. Al Smith saw burning crosses in a number of places where he campaigned. There was even threats of violence. And there was a respectable anti-Catholicism where they tried to pretend, well, it wasn't we're not against Al Smith because he's Catholic. We just don't like his stand on prohibition. And again, drawing a parallel to this year's campaign, I think Mitt Romney is facing a little bit of that. Not nearly as severe, obviously, but I do believe there's a lot of concern about his Mormonism, his religion. Like Al Smith, I think Mitt Romney keeps saying, well, I dealt with that in a speech a number of years ago. That's what Al Smith said in 28. Well, I dealt with that when I wrote this article in 1927. But ultimately, in the fall, Al Smith realized what a issue his religion was, and he finally had to make another big speech on it in Oklahoma City in September of 28, trying to put the issue to rest. He couldn't do that. So I'll make a prediction that Mitt Romney will probably figure out that probably later this year he's going to once again have to very directly confront those who have concerns or fears about his own religion and talk about it, because it's there, and the only way you can deal with it is by bringing it out into the open.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, thanks. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to talk about a third-party candidate, but one who was nearly president anyway. That was Henry Wallace, who had been vice president under Franklin Roosevelt from 1941 until 45. Indeed, if Roosevelt had died a few months before he did, then Henry Wallace would have been president. Now, he ran against, in 1948, Truman was so unpopular that the Democratic Party divided. The States' Rights Party, or Dixiecrats, seceded, and so did the left wing, the Progressive Party, under Henry Wallace. And I would say he was extremely important because he campaigned in the South. He and his vice presidential candidate, who was a Democratic senator from Idaho, Glenn Taylor. Glenn Taylor, for example, went to give a speech before the Southern Negro Youth Congress, SNCC, which would have the same name as the Southern Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee a decade or so later. But this SNCC, when Glenn Taylor went to go in the meeting hall in Birmingham, Alabama, Sheriff Bull Connor had him arrested for going in the wrong entrance. Wallace, when he spoke to integrated audiences in 1948 in the South. And this was, I would argue, the beginning of what we would call the civil rights movement. People like Daisy Bates, who would be so instrumental in the Central High in Little Rock, she supported the Progressive Party of Henry Wallace. Paul Robeson was the campaign manager. This was a black athlete and singer and actor and so forth. He came in the South. When he came in Louisiana, he couldn't even find people who were going to house him. I remember the land.
All right, let's get a response here so we can get other people in. Scott.
Well, first of all, you have very informed viewers at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Listeners, I should say. Yeah, I think, and it's wonderful. Henry Wallace is absolutely a very fascinating character. I didn't devote a chapter to Henry because I didn't think he came that close to being almost president. He ended up getting about 1 million votes, which, of course, is a very strong showing for a third party. And in 1948, of course, won the legendary elections because, as you already mentioned, in addition to Henry Wallace, Strom Thurmond ran on the States' Rights Party. I devote the chapter, though, on that election to Tom Dewey. Who everyone thought was going to win, and then lost, of course, in the big upset with when Truman came back and surprised all the pundits. Gallup had stopped polling. They were so sure that in the fall, because they were so sure there was no way for Truman to win. And so I talk a little bit about Tom Dewey's legacy, which was that I think that Tom Dewey established sort of the moderate Republicanism of the next 30, 40 years, because he said, look, well, there's no way we're going to roll back the New Deal. Any political party that talks about eliminating Social Security is going to be deader than a doornail. We've got to just find, progressive means to achieve liberal ends. And so I talk about Dewey's influence in that regard. And third parties generally, I focus mostly on Ross Perot. I think one person who generally had a chance, at least at one point in that election, to become the president of the United States. Wasn't able to do that for some quirky personality flaws, a little bit like Henry Wallace had some quirky flaws. Wallace, of course, got tied with being too cozy with communists. This was just as the sort of McCarthyism was taking off, and so that's really what crushed Henry Wallace's chances. He might have done better, but he got tarred with being too associated with communists.
And Ross Perot had way too many charts.
Way too many charts. He was a very, you know, he's still alive and a very interesting man, but a very strange man. He was paranoid. One of the stories I put in the book I had not heard about, he was convinced the Reagan administration wanted to assassinate him. So when he would travel to Washington, he would sign into one hotel, then he would sneak out the back, hop in a little Volkswagen Beetle at Columbia Park, drive to another hotel and register under an assumed name so nobody would know where he was. He was just a very unusual man, but he had a lot of followers. He talked directly about the deficit. And a lot of the things that he advocated in 1992 is what Newt Gingrich then added to the Contract for America that allowed Republicans to take back the House in 1994.
What in the world made him think Ronald Reagan wanted to assassinate him?
He kept talking. He was convinced that there was some illegal activity by the CIA with international drug cartels, that they were in cahoots with international drug cartels to raise money to fund counterinsurgency activities, including in Vietnam, and they were covering up the existence that there were still POWs held in Southeast Asia. So he really felt that he was being targeted by certain, at least elements within the government. I don't know if he ever actually directly accused Reagan. He really hated George H.W. Bush. They had a terrible relationship. And that was part of course, one of the reasons he ran in 92. He didn't like Bush.
Hugh, thanks for the call. Ned in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to mention Russ Feingold, who lost in 2010 as a leader of the progressive movement after the death in 2002 of Paul Wellstone from Minnesota. Those two were really the two strongest leaders of progressive politics in the United States. And as evidence, I'd like to cite when the Iraq War came up for a vote, the vote was 98-1, and the one vote against it was Russ Feingold. We've had a loss of freedom in our country, things like library records being invaded, and Russ Feingold was a champion against this type of invasion of our privacy. And he stood up for women's rights and a whole lot of issues on the progressive movement, environmental issues and so on, strong on education. It's really sad to see someone like Russ Feingold not in the political arena in some capacity, because his movement does continue, and he's been good at drumming up support for other progressive candidates, but I would like to see Russ himself as one of our politicians, and I think that that loss is a major one for our state and our country.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. Do you think that this holds true, Scott, for people who lose, who are prominent senators or governors, for that matter, who lose elections? Do they lose their clout, or is that a whole different arena?
It can be either way. I agree. I think, you know, I obviously focus on presidential losers, but I think, you know, it's a microcosm of all political races, that sometimes in your state, maybe a losing campaign for governor or a losing campaign for the Senate really galvanized a certain constituency that never been involved before. I'm from Wyoming originally, and so I remember there was a campaign in 1974, a man named Malcolm Wallop, who later became a U.S. senator. And he created sort of a new, younger generation of Republican enthusiasts. He was a viewed as a pro-environment Republican. And he created a whole new constituency and a whole new sort of political framework in Wyoming that hadn't existed before. And I'm assuming that there would be examples like that in all the states.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be interesting to hear of other people who think that, you know, I remember so-and-so ran for governor in Wisconsin or senator, but he lost. But boy, that was the campaign that got me involved in politics.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Ned, for your call. Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hey, when I was growing up as a kid, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and one of my favorite places to go was an area over in Berkeley called Tilden Park.
Mm.
And only later did I come to realize, or come to learn when I'm studying history, that a guy who actually not only got the popular vote, as I recall, he gets the popular vote against Rutherford B. Hayes, and he has a disputed, we'll see if this sounds familiar, a disputed count for the delegates to the college, the Electoral College, and it gets decided, as I recall, with a dispute over the Florida vote. Does any of this sound familiar?
A little bit.
And from this is I think is how Rutherford B. Hayes got the charming nickname Rutherfraud. I would like to hear your author's opinion about Mr. Tilden.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. Fine name, by the way. Yes, absolutely. One of the most fascinating elections in American history was the 1876 election between Samuel J. Tilden, governor of New York, and Rutherford B. Hayes. And you are exactly right. Tilden had won the popular vote fairly overwhelmingly, and it looked like he was going to go be president. But there were still three southern states, Florida, one of the three, that hadn't yet phoned in the results or telegraphed in the results in those days. And some of the folks at Republican National Headquarters suddenly dawned on them that if somehow Hayes could suddenly carry these three southern states, then he would be president and not Tilden. So there was a lot of shenanigans going along. Now, you would feel that Tilden really got robbed here, except for one thing. The Democrats were also involved in a lot of shenanigans. They, of course, were obviously already starting to suppress African-American votes in the South. So who defrauded who more is open to question. But Tilden, at least officially, probably would have won had there been fewer shenanigans. He took it well. He got criticized a lot like Gore did in 2000 for not being more aggressive in sort of asserting his claim to the office. Tilden was a lawyer, very shy, retiring guy, and he just kept believing in the rule of law. And then the other quirky thing about that, it did go to the Supreme Court to decide, in the sense that they decided to do this commission that had members of the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court, and they all tried to decide who was going to actually win. The rumor was there was a backroom deal that Hayes would agree to withdraw federal troops from the South and end Reconstruction if this commission agreed to give him the electors from these three southern states, and that's what happened. And so everybody seemed to go away happy, and poor Mr. Tilden never got to be president.
That's a fascinating story. Which brings us to Al Gore. You have three, you have a special chapter on three also-rans. Al Gore is one of them.
Yes. I was looking, I think, to me, it's a little too early, I suppose, to put the three most recent guys in historical context of what their elections really did. What I try to talk about is how they've all tried to redefine the role of loser. One of the things we've been talking about, Kathleen, is what a shame it is that we have these losing candidates that have all this knowledge and outstanding public service, and then we discard them because they're losers. But Gore, Kerry, and McCain have all tried to stay much more relevant, say, than Bob Dole or Mike Dukakis or Walter Mondale did before them. And so Gore, of course, has gone off on this crusade to try to raise world awareness of the threat of global climate change, won the Nobel Prize for it. John Kerry has gone back to the Senate instead of being a backbencher like McGovern and Humphrey talked about how people didn't even want to talk to them when they went back to the Senate, which is a shame. Kerry is the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, maybe Secretary of State if there's a second Obama term, tried very hard to be involved. And, of course, McCain, as I mentioned, tried very hard to resurrect this notion of being the titular head of the party by being the leading critic of the president he lost to. So that's where the chapter focuses on those three guys, about how they're trying to stay relevant. They're trying to put this notion that losers should disappear from history to rest, and they should stay as valuable contributors to the national debate.
Scott Ferris, our guest this hour, his book is Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Our phone number, thanks, Scott, as always, great to hear from you, is, did I give you the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Be in touch. We'll be with you, many more of you, in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Wednesday at 11, it's time for our regular holiday birdwatching show. Birding experts Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright join us to talk about the fledging that many birds are busy with right now. They have great tips for spotting those babies. That's Wednesday at 11 here on the Ideas Network.
Our next call is Larry in Oakdale. Hi, Larry.
Hi, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. My question is a little bit different than the other call-ins that you've had. I was a Democrat, but I'm no longer a Democrat ever since Barack Obama was elected. And with this negative campaign that's going on with the war on women, Howard Dean came out and stated that all Republicans hate Hispanics, anti-homophobic, and et cetera, et cetera. If Obama was to lose, how will he be remembered, and will, and does your guest believe that this kind of campaign rhetoric is going to hurt his place in history? I mean, let's face it, he is the first black president, so if he is defeated, this is going to be looked at a little differently than past presidents in our country's history. That's my question.
Scott.
Well, it's a very difficult question. Of course, my book focuses on those who don't have a presidential legacy to talk about. There are a number of people, obviously, who've run for president, lost the first time, like Jackson and Nixon, then won, or got elected president, and then were defeated, like, say, Carter and Bush, 41. So Obama will be judged by his presidential legacy more so than his campaigns, I think. You know, people will look at the Affordable Care Act and what he's done in terms of coming out for same-sex marriage and the stimulus package and all those things. And that's how he'll be judged in history. Obviously, though, the campaigns do leave an indelible mark on people who run, especially if they lose. And again, this kind of goes back. And you look at I'm going back to 48 again. That's a very interesting campaign. Harry Truman actually engaged in just awful rhetoric in 1948. He was very irresponsible. And I'm actually a Harry Truman fan. I think he made a lot of tremendously difficult but correct decisions in the wake of Roosevelt's death and the end of World War II. But his 1948 campaign, he started comparing Republicans to Nazis and really sort of over-the-top language and really offensive, and yet he won. And so people kind of forget about that. And what we remember about the 48 campaign is what a scrappy campaign it was and what a great underdog Truman made. Dewey, on the other hand, tried very hard to stay above the plane. He had sort of engaged in some questionable tactics in 44 when he ran against Roosevelt the first time, deeply regretted it, and it just announced in 1948 that no matter what Truman said, he was going to try to ignore it and stay above the fray, and he lost. And so what do people remember about that? Well, Tom Dewey was a terrible campaigner, just sat on his hands, didn't respond in kind. And so I guess the answer to the caller's question essentially is if you win, ugly tactics are quickly forgotten, but if you lose, that they stay with you the rest of your life.
Thanks, Larry. Joanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne. She's not there. Mark in Eau Claire. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I just had a comment and a question. As everyone knows, we have a election coming up in a few weeks where Mr. Barrett lost to Governor Walker last time around, and many of us are hopeful that he will sort of turn that around. But related to that, other than Nixon, have there been any sort of loser politicians who have then made a comeback to win the presidency?
Thank you. That's a good question. The only other one who lost and then came back to win was Andrew Jackson. He lost in 1824 and then came back in 1828. And the reason he was able to come back so successfully is that in 1824, I mentioned a little earlier in the show, you know, that there were three men who went to the House of Representatives. Henry Clay was the deciding factor. He decided to back John Quincy Adams and gave him the presidency. And then John Quincy Adams asked Henry Clay to be his Secretary of State. So the Jackson people accused Clay and Adams of having this corrupt bargain where Clay sold his support in return for being Secretary of State. That gave Jackson a huge boost to come back in 1828 and win. In fact, Jackson had started, you would think campaigns are long today, Jackson basically started campaigning immediately in 1825 after the House awarded the election to Adams. So that's the only other time. It's extremely difficult to bounce back from losing. I mentioned the Clay, William Jennings Bryan, Adlai Stevenson, Tom Dewey, all nominated multiple times, all did worse in their subsequent elections. Dewey did a little better in 48 than he did in 44, but all of them, none of them were able to come back and win again. And even if you're the losing vice presidential nominee, only twice has the losing vice presidential nominee been able to come back and win the nomination even, and only one won the presidency. That was Roosevelt, who was the vice presidential nominee in 1920 when James Cox lost to Warren Harding. 12 years later, Roosevelt's president. The other one is Bob Dole, losing vice presidential candidate with Gerald Ford. Took 20 years for him to get the nomination in 1996, and then he lost to Bill Clinton. So once you lose, it's tough to come back.
That's remarkable. That's remarkable history. Thanks, Mark. Joanne is with us in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I have a question about someone who ran for president and wondered if he had talked about her, Shirley Chisholm. Didn't have a big campaign, but did have a little bit of impact on American politics. Did you write about her?
I did. She's not, unfortunately, get a chapter. She is a very interesting woman. I think I briefly mentioned her in the McGovern chapter because she ran in 72. Certainly one of the first women and certainly the first African Americans to be seriously considered as a strong contender. She didn't become the nominee. So my book focuses primarily on people who were nominees of the major party. or who were very strong third-party candidates. And really, Perot, I sort of has a stand-in for all the third party. But I agree with you, Shirley Chisholm, a fascinating character, but really didn't come too close to being president, though, even though she did influence the politics of 1972.
Thanks, Joanne. So of all of these people, who stands out as, in your mind, as the person who really should have been president?
Well, I have two judgments on that, and so I have two factors. One is, did they have the stuff to be a great chief executive? I mean, all these people were very interesting people. They had great accomplishments. But would they have been good presidents? Did they have legislative or executive experience and really leadership qualities? But then the other thing you have to answer is, would they also have been superior to the person they lost to? So you go to 1860. Stephen Douglas might have made an outstanding president. Could you really choose him over Abraham Lincoln?
No.
So the two I pick would be Henry Clay, who we've talked a lot about.
Yes.
I think he would have been a wonderful president in 1832 because Andrew Jackson's second term was not very successful.
Right.
The country would have been better off, I think, with Henry Clay in 32.
And we have to we're almost out of time.
And 48, Tom Dewey, I think, would have been better than Harry Truman's second term. It would have been a superior president.
Oh, I'm glad.
Truman's great accomplishments were his first term. His second term was also a disaster.
Well, the book is fascinating, and you are a great guest. Thanks, Scott, so much.
Thank you, Kathleen. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, our pleasure. Scott Ferris, the book is Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. That was fascinating. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations on their way.